Welcome to the Decaf Show.
Hey there, welcome back to another episode of the Decaf Show with Sid, Mon and Key. After a long time, all three of us are recording an episode together. In this episode of our Friday Talks today, we have a super cool guest, Mackenzie Finkley. She is an American anthropologist and lifelong museum enthusiast. She is a young professional who studied at the University of Texas at Austin, earning a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology, a minor in Architecture, and a certificate in Museum Studies. In April of 2019, she was invited to speak at the TEDx conference at UT Austin about her research on internet memes and cyberculture. She has a long history of previous leadership roles and a vibrant fascination with displays of human culture. She is borderline obsessed with two things in her life, museums and a tabby cat, Owen. She is compelled to write her book Beyond the Halls, an insider's guide to loving museums as a way to share her passion for museums in a practical and fun approach so that everyone can have the opportunity to cherish and admire museums as much as she does. Welcome to the show.
My name is Mackenzie Finkley. I am an anthropologist, an author, and a museum enthusiast.
Why did you want to become an anthropologist in the first place?
That is an excellent question. It was something that I stumbled upon. A lot of people will tell you when they decide on what job they wanted to have, they'll say, oh, it was something I always knew. And this very much was not the case. In fact, it's something that I probably, and truthfully, held quite a bit of prejudice against initially. So when I started my degree, I started in a STEM field. That was what I was, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. That was what I was pushed to do just in general. People told me, you know, you're good at math and science. You should use your brain for that, and it'll earn you a lot of money, and that's what you should go and study. And I was like, okay. So I went and I started my degree as a civil engineer. And what I ended up learning that I liked the most about civil engineering was the human interaction with the built environment. And turns out that has a lot to do with anthropology, which initially was a field that I knew next to nothing about. As far as I was concerned, as you know, an 18-year-old in the science fields, anthropology was a humanities course and meh, who really needs it? So after I learned more about what interests me in humans interacting with the built environment and how important it is to build for humans, because they're the ones using the spaces that we're building, analyzing the way that they've evolved, the way they behave, how various cultures interact, and how that matters in design, I was like, this is really interesting. I want to learn more about this. But the engineering degree was like, no, that's pretty much it. Now you get more math and physics. And I was like, but what if? So I switched and changed my degree entirely to anthropology and minored in architecture.
That's a huge switch.
It is a huge switch. It really is. And now what I've, you know, come to study more than anything else is cultural heritage on display. Mm-hmm. Completely left engineering behind.
Was it difficult for you to change from engineering to anthropology?
Yes. I ended up with approximately 18 credit hours that didn't count towards any of the degree requirements. I still learned a lot in those 18 credit hours. I like to joke sometimes that I got half an engineering degree. So whenever I'm able to successfully solve a puzzle or open a jar, right? But it was challenging. But what made it easier was how much I ended up falling in love with anthropology and how much I loved learning and how much I enjoyed my classes and wanted to go to every single one.
So you love everything about museums, right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I wouldn't say I love everything about museums. It certainly has. Yeah, it certainly has its sticking points and its shady cultural history at times. Mm-hmm. But I do really love museums as a concept, as an institution, as a learning opportunity.
What's your first experience of being in a museum?
Oh, wow. What is my first experience in a museum? You know, it probably was something that I don't even remember because I was so young. I was fortunate to grow up in a city that had a really wonderful museum, still has a really wonderful museum landscape. So, multiple museums to enjoy and go to. And I was also, again, fortunate enough that my parents would take me to them. Probably the first museum that I visited, and my parents would be able to correct me, but I don't remember. But most likely, the first museum I visited was the Children's Museum in Houston, Texas, which I have fleeting memories here and there of going, shapes and colors flying by, and all those different things. But what's really great about that museum is how incredibly interactive it is.
Well, we'll visit it as we get a chance. What specifically in a museum that inspires the way you live?
Oh, wow. That's such a thought-provoking question. I believe that the way that museums inspire the way that I live is through the love of learning and all of the learning opportunities and the opportunity for growth, because museums don't stay the same forever. They don't open their doors and then never change. They're always, and perhaps sometimes more slowly than some more slowly than others, they're always updating their collections, updating the information that they know and that they teach to the general public. And I love visiting them. So perhaps that also greatly affects my life because, especially in the before times, before COVID kept me inside a lot more than usual, I was visiting museums, especially in my studies, at least one a week, many times more than one a week. And that affected my lifestyle. Like that was my hobby. That was my thing that I would do. I would go and visit museums or historical houses or libraries and take in new information and then want to talk about this new information with other people. So in many ways, every visit and every experience shapes the person that I am today.
Sounds interesting. How did COVID affect you that you used to visit one museum a week? You used to. So how, what was the effect that COVID didn't allow you to visit museums, right? How was it?
Yes, it was hard because here's the other thing that happened. The really tragic thing was that in the beginning of the COVID pandemic in the United States and the first major shutdown, all the museums closed and they weren't allowing any visitors, right? Many museums rely on ticket sales to keep their doors open, to continue to run and function as a business. And so many museums ended up closing permanently. Many museums are on the brink of closing permanently. And that prevents anyone who has never seen them from ever seeing them. And there are all these stories and history and artifacts that are just lost, gone. And fortunately, this hasn't happened. Fortunately, this didn't happen to everyone. There's still many museums that are now reopened. They might have modified hours. Most museums now, you have to purchase a timed ticket. So I will say, when things were getting much better, in June, I went and I was in New York City for a professional publishing program at New York University. And I was there for 3 weeks. And in those 3 weeks was when New York City was starting to open back up. There were increasingly more and more people. It's crazy to think that this was in June. There were more and more people in the streets every day. And I actually did have the opportunity to visit. Oh gosh, in the 3 weeks, I probably visited at least 8 to 10 museums. New York has over 110 major museums to visit, but I tried to make a little dent. And most of the places I went, I had to purchase or reserve. So either purchase a time ticket or reserve a free ticket and attend at a specific time. So that way there weren't as many people in the building, to prevent the spread of disease. And personally, I like going to museums when they're not super crowded. So the timed ticket is not something I'm mad about.
It's sad, but in some way it's cool that, you know, the crowd doesn't exist. So what was the strangest thing in a museum to ever happen?
Wow. That I know of. The strangest thing in a museum to ever happen, or the strangest thing that maybe I have heard or seen.
Seen, maybe?
Yeah, I've seen, you know, a good number of really strange to me works of sculpture. And the interesting thing about sculpture and art museums is it will initially appear very strange at face value. And the particular piece of work that I'm thinking of was one that I saw recently at a contemporary art museum in Houston, where there was an entire banner. Think of like a wall hanging, a woven wall hanging, made out of human hair. And yeah, so when you first walk up to it, you're like, that doesn't look quite right. And then you read the description and they're like, it's human hair. And you're like, ah, okay. Don't really care for that. Makes me feel a little squeamy. But then when you read further and you're provided with more context, it talks about how the story of refugees from Colombia and how the hair was taken from women in the village who were providing other people with haircuts, and the ways that community helps one another and all these different things. And I was like, wow, you painted a really beautiful story. But sometimes artwork is really hard to take in at face value.
So do you see any cultural differences in whether how people like to participate around the world?
Absolutely. I think that the places where museums are most successful definitely shows a degree of either cultural interest or cultural wealth, truthfully. The number one most visited museum in the world, and I forget where it is, I want to say it's Singapore. But the other thing that you can notice is the number one most visited museum in any given country says a lot about what's culturally important to that country. For example, the number one most visited museum in the United States is the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. The Smithsonian is government funded and it's free. So that definitely helps with the visitation. It's enormous, but the Air and Space Museum, it's a very specific thing to be the number one museum. It's all about planes, rockets, the International Space Race, which the United States feels very prideful about. It's about military vehicles and military planes, the World Wars, again, a big point of pride for many Americans. So it's interesting to me because it's not my personal favorite museum or even one that's even in my top five. But it definitely says a great deal about what's culturally important to the United States. So you could look at the same thing in any country that you're at. I would encourage you to look up what's the number one most visited museum in your country or even in your state or city or region.
Well, can you name the top five museums which you just mentioned?
The top five museum, like personal ones that I love the most?
Yes.
Okay. So I like that you're encouraging me to choose top five because choosing a favorite is kind of challenging. I will say that from my perspective and of the museums that I have visited, the ones that I have enjoyed the most, the Houston Museum of Natural Science is certainly up there. It's In my top five museums that I really love, there's definitely the Houston Museum of Natural Science. It's one that I grew up going to a lot. They consistently have really wonderful exhibits and really great interactives. So that's one that I continue to support and enjoy going to visit. Another one in my top five is the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, which just built an entirely new building dedicated to contemporary and modern art. So they have three buildings, but that contemporary and modern art building, not only is it absolutely beautiful, but it's provided me with a new learning opportunity for getting closer to contemporary and modern art, understanding it better and gaining a new perspective. Another one that's certainly in my top five, and I have a love-hate relationship with it, I really do, is the British Museum. It is absolutely incredible to see all of those things in one place from across the world, as far afield as you can get from London, and thousands of years of human history in one place. The thing that gets me, though, is where those objects came from and how perhaps unethically they were obtained. But it is beautiful. It is incredible to see all of those things, and it's so great. Another one of my top five is the Smithsonian Museum of American History. I think it's a really fun place to visit and a great way to learn about American history in one place in many different facets. They talk about technology. They talk about the founding of the United States and some of the founding documents. And they also talk about American pop culture. So some of that stays current, some of it's pop culture through history, just really fun and visual way to get a glimpse at the culture in the United States. And finally, certainly not least, it's hard to say really where it ranks in my top five, but it is certainly up there, is the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It is just such a magical place. And I know that's such a cliche thing to say about New York City, but it's an enormous institution full of really beautiful works of art. But the architecture of the entire museum is also just really particularly stunning, especially the Hall of Ancient Artifacts and Egyptian Works of Art, I find particularly beautiful. So those are my personal top five.
Amazing. I really like to visit a lot of museums and galleries. When you visit museums, is there any particular type you kind of resonate with more than the other ones?
Yes, actually, you know, truthfully, I would say that my heart belongs to natural history and science museums. Mm-mm-mm. It's a big point of personal interest for me. I love to learn about how the world works, you know, how we came to be here, how different facets of learning and understanding and updating my knowledge from what I learned in my high school science classes, right? Mm-mm.
Do you like collect something as a hobby?
I do collect something, and it's not necessarily, I mean, I guess it is part of my hobby. So I like to get a magnet from the museum gift shop of every museum that I visit. So as you can imagine, I have a lot of magnets.
So here's my question. If you could, you know, live at any time, what year or period would you choose?
I love this question, and I'm so glad you asked. So I recently was able to get, recently being like maybe a couple months ago, but I was able to get a time ticket and go visit the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. And I went and I saw this exhibit on Impressionist paintings. And the Impressionist period of art is primarily in the late, think like the 1880s to the early 1910s. And as I'm looking at all of these works of art and reading about these wonderful artists and the community that they had and how they would like paint together and enjoy each other's company. And then the imagery that they would paint of like these fabulous, clubs like Moulin Rouge or the places that they would hang out together in Paris, and just aside from all of the other surely terrible things and perhaps lack of medical advancement at the time, I think it would be really fun to have been born in the 1870s and just live from that time, you know, and grow old through the 20s and the 30s and just experience all of the wonderful things. And I can't help but think about how many less people there were on the planet in that time was another thing that I find myself thinking about a lot, because, you know, throughout my entire life, there have been at least 6 billion people or more on the planet. And now we're, you know, far surpassing 8. The world population today is 1,860 times the size that it was just 12 millennia ago. When the world was approximately around 4 million, which is half the current population of London. So the world has grown really fast over a really short period of time. And that's just something I find myself thinking a lot about. Now, 4 millennia ago is a lot different than, you know, 2 centuries ago, but it still paints a powerful picture.
Yeah, the Renaissance period is quite fun, makes you wonder how the world evolved.
Yeah.
Exactly. Have you ever found some weird scribbles and paintings or behind paintings?
Yeah, there's plenty of weird things, honestly, that are on display in museums. And especially in art museums, a lot of people, the entirety of contemporary art is, or modern art for that matter, is mostly modern art, is I could have done that. Yeah, but you didn't. Like, you look at a painting, you go, I could do that. I could go home and I could recreate a Jackson Pollock by just splattering paint on the floor. Yeah, but you didn't. And what ultimately matters, like what can look really strange to face value, what can look like, you know, splatters, miscellaneous splatters of paint on a page, ultimately comes down to context. And you can start to really think about how the artist was feeling or even picturing how they moved when they were creating that work of art. And I think that's what provides the most entertainment value for me. In one of a recent exhibits that I went to, it was a exhibit of art spanning 3 centuries of American art. And I was in kind of the more modern art section. And there was this painting where it was just like, imagine taking a brush and dunking the entire thing in a bucket of paint, and then just like slashing it across a canvas. And so I'm standing there and I'm looking at this and I'm like doing the motions with my hands to try to figure out how the artist moved to create the picture. It's really fun for me to envision, and it certainly adds to the value of the experience.
Have you ever thought that digitalization is affecting museums in any way?
It is big time. You know, in fact, it's making museums more accessible to people who perhaps can't visit them because for mobility reasons, for accessibility reasons, because maybe they don't have, if the institution isn't free, and also just geographically. It's expensive to travel, and travel is, it's far. It's kind of the nature of it, right? So being able to access all of this educational material from the comfort of your home is really powerful and speaks volumes about the evolution of the internet and how much knowledge we have access to.
That's right. So yeah, there are many different ways, you know, a museum could protect their, belongings and stuff. So like, have you seen or ever wondered how do they actually keep it safe?
Yes.
Because I didn't even know.
Yeah. So museums have a variety of levels of funding. And with that variety comes varying levels of security measures. So some museums have the luxury of overnight security guards that literally protect the museum on the night shift when there is no one there. And that's going to be museums probably like the Louvre, right? Fun fact. So the Mona Lisa, world famous painting that pretty much everyone has seen and can recognize, is really only that famous because it was stolen twice. And so, as you can imagine, the security measures for especially the Mona Lisa painting are incredibly high. And that painting is the most insured, the highest insured piece of work in the world. So,
and it's also the most visited museum too.
Yes. So varying levels. And then there was like a museum on my university's campus that I worked at for a time that had one full-time security guard, just the one. And he would sit at a desk and he would monitor the cameras. So the museum didn't even have gallery attendants to monitor people and make sure they didn't touch or steal things. But we had one guard and he would sit at the desk and he would work all day. And he would close the museum at night and turn on the alarms and he would go home. So big differences in how things are protected. And then you also have, so for the archives, the US archives, you have the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, you know, these founding documents of the United States that literally lower into the floor into a vault at night. Which is just absolutely crazy to protect people from. Not only that, you can't even smash and grab the documents because they're behind bulletproof glass with heat sensing lasers. So if you get too close to the document. So all of these things you can also learn from super fun Nicolas Cage film, National Treasure. But yeah, super varying degrees of security in museums.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a Mission Impossible plot.
Yeah.
We'll get to your book, Beyond the Halls.
Yeah. Beyond the Halls, An Insider's Guide to Loving Museums is just that. I, in the creation of this book, was looking to make something that was a accessible marriage of a museum history textbook and a general museum guidebook, because you'll often find there are many museum guidebooks out there. They're usually for very specific regions or very specific types of art or periods of art or types of artifacts. But I wanted something that was very general, that was accessible to a wide audience and not just museum studies students, right? So what you'll find in the book is it's broken down into seven different sections. It's kind of the way I put it together. And these seven different sections, and trust me, it's not a super long book. You could read it in a day if you wanted to. The seven different sections are based on kind of seven different types of people or areas of interest that I imagine people would be interested in when thinking about museums. So you've got the novice, and that answers questions like, what is a museum, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what can I do in them? How can I experience them? And starts to introduce the different types of museums that exist. And then you have the historian, the curator, the skeptic. So that's, I really like that section because that's meant for people who maybe don't think that museums matter and don't see the importance. And so that's my like love letter to the skeptic. The businessman, because museums are businesses. Mm-hmm. And talking about the way that they function, the way that they make money and all those things. The activist is one of the last sections. And that one's a really special one to me because that talks about museum ethics, which is an important topic that is not often discussed, especially amongst visitors. And it's important to know where these things came from. And finally, the enthusiast, which is me. So that's kind of more of my closing thoughts, conclusion, and the origin of how this book was written and how I fell in love with museums.
Is there any particular reason you wanted to write a book?
I think that in many ways, without knowing it, I've always wanted to write a book. Like when I was in middle school, I tried to start writing a book in my journal about life and my experience and dealing with other people. Middle school was a hard time for many, especially in America. But I've also been a writer for quite a while. And I would write so much for my degree in anthropology. That's like how they tested you on pretty much everything, is writing essays, research papers, etc. So I had all of this work that I had done, and I was like, you know what, some of this is pretty good, like I want to do something with this. And so much of my research that I had done in my studies for museum studies and anthropology did find its way in various ways into the book. So a lot of it was packaged and repurposed. And then the book also includes just a bunch of information that I researched exclusively for the book, in addition to a lot of fun anecdotes and stories about the places that I've been and the really great museums that are doing really great things.
Nice.
That is really cool. So your favorite interview in the book?
My favorite interview in the book was definitely my very first interview that I did. The first interview that I did for the book was with Dr. Dirk Van Turenhout, who is the curator of anthropology at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. So as you can imagine, as a budding anthropologist, I was completely over the moon to have him tell me that, yeah, absolutely, you can come into my office and interview me. And what made this so cool was, you know, he's sending me the information about how to come to his office and how to visit. And I'm like, I know where the Houston Museum of Natural Science is. I go there all the time. But the address that he gives me is a different address than the address of the museum. I was like, oh, okay. So I start driving. I get there and I'm driving and I turn into basically what's a neighborhood. And it'll be like, you know, condo, condo. And then there was a small and creepy building, and then condo, condo, condo. And I was like, and the address was for this small and creepy building that had this gate I had to be buzzed into. Turns out that building, not only does it house many offices for many of the curatorial staff at the Houston Museum of Natural Science, but it is also a major vault for their collection. And one of the top four places in Houston you are not supposed to know exists. So I got to go in and sit in his office and interview him. And he just talked for like 2 hours, was telling amazing stories. And I just had the most fun listening to him and his life and the incredible places that he had been and things that he had done in the pursuit of anthropology and cultural preservation.
Wow.
Yeah.
So here's the last question. Okay, why do you think young people or people in general should use museums?
Oh, yes. I 100% want to encourage young people to visit museums, because people who go to museums as a young age are far more likely to be people that continue to visit museums in their adult life. And those are also the people who tend to be donors or support museums or volunteer at them. And that's what keeps museums alive. That's what keeps their doors open. A lot of museums are nonprofit institutions and they rely on the support of their audience, as many of us do, to support them and to continue to function. And why that is important is because museums are places where history is preserved and culture is on display. And it's such a unique place for all of these things to live and exist. And without them, where would all that go? How would we learn? Maybe in textbooks, but it's just not the same as getting to see history alive, culture in person, in a very real and tangible way.
Definitely. So, well, I guess that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining and sharing a lot of things which we didn't know. And we will definitely, if we get a chance, visit all the museums. It's you with me.